chapter 35. 2 Chronicles chapter 35. And we're reading from the verse number 20. 2 Chronicles chapter 35. And we're reading from the verse number 20. After all this, when Josiah had prepared the temple, Necho, king of Egypt, came up to fight against Carchemish by Euphrates, and Josiah went out against him. But he sent ambassadors to him, saying, "What have I to do with thee, thou king of Judah? I come not against thee this day, but against the house wherewith I have war. For God commanded me to make haste, forbear thee from meddling with God, who is with me, that he destroy thee not." Nevertheless, Josiah would not turn his face from him, but disguised himself that he might fight with him, and hearkened not unto the words of Necho from the mouth of God, and came to fight in the valley of Megiddo. And the archers shot at King Josiah. And the king said to his servants, "Have me away, for I am sore wounded." His servants therefore took him out of that chariot and put him in the second chariot that he had. And they brought him to Jerusalem, and he died, and was buried in one of the sepulchres of his fathers. And all Judah and Jerusalem mourned for Josiah. And Jeremiah lamented for Josiah, and all the singing men and singing women spake of Josiah in their lamentations to this day, and made them an ordinance in Israel, and behold, they are written in the lamentations. For the rest of the acts of Josiah, and his goodness according to that which was written in the law of the Lord, and his deeds first and last, behold, they are written in the book of the kings of Israel and Judah. Amen. And we know God will add his own blessing to the reading of his inspired and infallible word. Whenever we look at the epitaph, the description of Josiah's reign after his death in the verse 26, you will see the word goodness. Now, the rest of the acts of Josiah and his goodness. This was a good king. And throughout this section of the book of Chronicles, we have looked very closely at the reign of King Josiah. And we have noticed the great things that he did in leading the country back to God. The influence that he had, not only in Judah, but throughout the other tribes of Israel as well, who had already been taken captive by the Assyrians. And so Josiah did a good and a lasting work. But there was a shadow that loomed over him continually. Death was coming. And he was quite a young man here in the time of his death. He came to reign at just as a boy. And he had reigned for 30 years. So he was 38 years of age. He hadn't seen his 40th birthday as yet. And so he was a young man, but yet he knew that death was coming. And the reason why he knew that death was coming was because of the words of Huldah the prophetess, who said that judgment would fall upon this nation for their sins, but judgment would not fall upon you. You will not live to see that judgment. You will be spared that. And so throughout the remaining years of Josiah's reign, he saw revival. He saw that great Passover. He saw years of blessing. He saw the people turning afresh to God. But yet he spent those years of blessing under the very shadow of death. He knew that death was coming. And he knew that judgment was visiting his country. And no doubt as he looked at his children, and as he thought of their future, and as he looked at the children that were growing up in Judah and Jerusalem at that time, he must have had a broken heart. Because he knew the day was coming, perhaps fairly soon, when he would be taken away, when death would be visited upon him, and then the end would come for Jerusalem and for this glorious temple. In the providence of God, we see good times. We see times of blessing and we see times of refreshing, but we also see bad times, horrible times, tragic times. They're all part of the tapestry that God is weaving. Gold threads and dark threads. They're all there, part of his pattern. We can't see the pattern, but one day we will. And this was a dark thread that God was weaving in his pattern here in 2 Chronicles chapter 35. In the providence of God, the time had come when a good king must die. And in the providence of God, that date would be the 30th year of his reign. So let's think tonight about the death of a good king. First of all, let's notice the clash of nations. We are told in verse 20 of 2 Chronicles 35, after all this, when Josiah had prepared the temple. So after the temple was prepared, after the great Passover, and it came some years after that, some 12 years, Necho, king of Egypt, came up to fight against Carchemish by Euphrates. Now we know from history that this was the year 609 BC. It was a very significant time in the history of the world. Nineveh had fallen. Nineveh was the capital city of the Assyrians, the hub of their great empire. And if ever you're privileged enough to walk through the British Museum in London, you will see the artifacts that have been taken from the old Assyrian Empire. You will see the amazing statues and carvings. You will see their library. You will see their wall murals. And you will see all the trappings of opulence that characterized the Assyrians. But then 612 BC came and the Babylonians surrounded Nineveh. And great Nineveh fell. And now we come to 609 BC, 3 years after the fall of Nineveh. The Assyrians are not quite defeated, but this would be a significant year, because this would be the year the Assyrians would vanish from history completely. And this man, Carchemish, he would be the final king of Assyria. A great superpower would be no more, be annihilated, out of existence. That was going to happen in the year 609 BC. Things were changing rapidly in the world. And in verse 20, what we see is the death throes of a great empire. And this man, Carchemish, is trying to gather together what forces he has, and he's trying to make a stand, and he's trying to carve out some kind of territory. And the Babylonians, they're rising in power as well, and he's trying to hold on to his power. And then you have Egypt coming up from the south, and Egypt's trying to get in the action. And they're trying to capitalize on the weakness of the Assyrians, and they're trying to seize some territory for themselves. It was a real cauldron of international politics. It was a real cauldron of war and bloodshed. Nations vying against nations for supremacy, trying to find a place for themselves against this background of Babylonian power rising to the ascendancy. There was a new world order rising. And that's what was happening here at this time. And it was inevitable that Judah was going to get caught in the crossfire. Because to the north of Judah, you had the Assyrian forces. And to the northeast of Judah, you had the Babylonian forces. And to the south of Judah, you had the forces of Egypt. And Judah was caught right in the middle. And therefore, while Josiah did not go looking for war in this particular year, while he did not go seeking war, the war came to him. It came right to his territory, and it came within his boundaries. And it was going to change the course of the world, and it was going to be the means whereby his life would be taken away into the world that is to come. Nothing much changes in the world, does it? International politics, military power and might being exercised, intrigue and conspiracy, nations vying for supremacy. We see it all. We've seen it all in world history since this. We see it all here. 609 BC would be a year that would change the world forever, I suppose. And there have been other years that have changed the world forever. 1914 changed the world. 1939 changed the world. You know, we're looking across at Ukraine at this time, and We're seeing the world being changed very rapidly. Just today, Mr. Johnson, if you've seen the news, has signed this deal with Sweden and Finland, countries who for centuries have been independent, neutral, not getting involved in international alliances, and now they've signed an alliance with Britain. And Mr. Johnson has promised to come to their aid if they are attacked by Russia, and now they want to get into NATO. Things are changing rapidly. And you think of the power of these great superpowers in the world. You think of their military might. You think of their nuclear arsenal, which is the most frightening thing of all. And one wonders where all this is leading to. You know, Judah was caught in the middle. No nation is an island. Whenever there's change in the world, it affects everyone. I just saw last night that there's billions of pounds of grain sitting in Ukraine. They can't get it out. And that's going to have an impact upon the world. It's going to have an impact upon food and the price of food and upon all kinds of things. Fertilizer is going to have a massive impact unless something changes. And yet we know that God is in control. And that's the great comfort. Here we have nations fighting against nations. War, and it's all going on. But God has determined that this would be the year when Josiah would die. Because God is in control. God has an overruling eye upon his church. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what tomorrow holds, let alone next year. But we are certain that God is leading us all to the second coming of his Son. God is building up his church. And God will protect his bride until that moment in time. But there's something that we must do. We must get the message out with growing determination and with resolve and with vision that the only hope for this nation and for this society and for this world is the hope of the gospel. There's nothing else, no one else but Christ. And men and women need to realize that they're on a collision course with the wrath of God. Unless they meet the Lord in his mercy. And that's the only thing that will ever change the world for good. The only thing that will change the world for good is the gospel. And Paul said that we have got this treasure in earthen vessels. We have got this treasure within us. Let's use the treasure for the glory of God in these difficult days. And so we see the clash of nations. Let's also notice Josiah, faithful to the last. From what I have read, some commentators, perhaps quite a number of commentators, have been very critical of Josiah here and his part in the war. And I really don't think that's justified. Because we have to look at what's going on here. The Egyptian forces have swept up through Judah and have come to the valley of Megiddo, which is just northwest of Jerusalem, not far from Mount Carmel, near the shore of the Mediterranean. And they have come right into the very heart of Judah. So what is Josiah going to do? Is he going to just let these forces come? If he lets them come and if they go on to the Euphrates to fight against the Assyrians, well, whoever wins is going to come back down into his territory and he's going to get swallowed up. As I said earlier, the war came to him. He didn't go to the war. And his national sovereignty was under threat here. What could he do? Now, the Egyptian emperor sent messengers to him, ambassadors, we're told in verse 21, who pleaded with him. What have I to do with thee, thou king of Judah? I am not come against thee this day, but against the house for which I have made war. For God commanded me to make haste, forbear thee from meddling with God who is with me, that he destroy thee not. And so the king of Egypt, he said, look, I haven't come to make war with you. I'm come to make war with the Assyrians. Therefore, don't hinder me in my work. But yet this same king of Egypt had come through uninvited into another state. So what was Josiah to do? He believed that his only option was to stand and fight. After all, the Jews saw this territory not just as land. The Jews saw this territory as God's spiritual inheritance that God had given to him, to his fathers before him. The territory that God had promised to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. This was the Lord's heritage. And therefore he was going to stand and fight and defend the heritage that God had given to him. And I believe that Josiah was right to stand and fight. And I don't believe that Josiah's death was a sign of God's displeasure with him. I believe that Josiah's death was according to the providence of God. This was how it was determined so to be. But this is the point that we've got to get here. Huldah the prophetess said, when you die, judgment will come upon your nation. And now Josiah was dead. This was not a judgment upon him. The removal of Josiah was a judgment upon his nation. The removal of this good king, who was faithful to the last, defending his nation. The removal of this good king was a judgment upon the nation. God at times removes his good and godly servants. He chooses to take them out of the sin and wickedness of this world and to promote them to glory. To get them away from all that's going on here below. And when he removes them, he removes their influence, he removes their prayers, he removes the good work that they're doing. And there's a judgment comes upon the people that are left. And it would seem to me from the way things went in the land after Josiah's death, that while there were many who supported his great revival, there were many, perhaps even a majority, that did not support the revival. And this judgment was a visitation upon them for their failings. I think of the words of Elisha, fairly significant, when Elijah was gone. How did Elijah go into heaven? He went in to heaven in a whirlwind, but there was a chariot of fire. And the chariot of fire was very symbolic, because the chariot was to the ancient army what the tank is to the modern army. And an army was measured in ancient times according to the number of chariots and horses. And the more chariots and horses you had, the stronger you were and the more difficult you were to break down. And therefore, the man of God was the chariot of Israel. The man of God was the strength of Israel. A prophet of God, a man like Elijah, who could stand on his own on Mount Carmel, defeat all of those prophets of Baal. A man like that was the very secret of a nation's strength. But God took his servant away, and Elisha cried out, my father, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof. He knew that the nation would be weaker because God had taken a faithful servant away. I think of faithful servants of God that we have lost. People that once sat with us in prayer meetings. People that prayed with us and for us. And when God takes them home, we are the poorer because they are gone. But when God takes home a faithful man of God in his prime, 38 years of age, and he hasn't been taken away because he's been chastened, he hasn't been taken away because of a poor influence, he's been taken away so that judgment will come upon the land. That's a catastrophe and a disaster, and it's solemn beyond words. It makes me think of the death of C.H. Spurgeon. C.H. Spurgeon's ministry was remarkably blessed in central London. He was the greatest of the Victorian preachers. Ministered to 6,000 people Sunday after Sunday for many, many years. When he first came as a young man, a very young man, to London, he took the city by storm and many were converted and had to build the great tabernacle at the Elephant and Castle to house the people that came to hear him preach. There were times during his ministry that the whole congregation just vacated the building to let the visitors in. And once again, it was filled with visitors. Many came to hear him. Many dignitaries came to hear him. But it said that the Queen herself, she came in disguise. And in those days, people didn't have the photographs and the means of identifying dignitaries the way they have today. And it was believed Queen Victoria came in disguise to the tabernacle to hear Mr. Spurgeon preach. Mr. Spurgeon was a gospel man. He believed firmly in the old ways, and the inspiration of the scripture, and the atonement of the blood, and the necessity of regeneration. You must be born again, and his sermons were printed and went throughout the world. But within the Baptist Union in Great Britain at that time, there was a subtle influence creeping in. The German school of rationalism, which questioned the inspiration of the Bible, which questioned whether the first books of the Bible written by Moses. And of course, if you undermine Moses, you undermine Christ, because the law was given by Moses. Grace and truth came by Christ. You undermine Moses, you undermine the whole of the scripture. You take away the foundation. You start to attack the gospel. And these pastors that were accepting this German school of rationalism, they didn't talk much about it. They didn't preach about it. They were reading the books. They were filling their minds with it. They were talking about it in secret. They were slowly accepting it. And Spurgeon knew about it. But it was very difficult for him to deal with it. Because those that were following this German school of thought that was opposed to the gospel, they wouldn't come out in open debate. And Spurgeon felt he had to do something, and he had to take a stand. It was known as the downgrade controversy. And so he confronted the matter head on. And he lost many friends. Young men that he had put through the ministry, the Baptist college that he himself had started, it was the Spurgeon College in London. He paid for them himself to be trained for ministry. They turned their backs on him. He was left in his own congregation. They supported him, but the whole experience, losing fellowship with brethren he had to fellowship with over all his life, it broke his heart. And as many, many believe that it was that hastened his death at 56 years of age. No one influenced London quite like the Prince of Preachers, but like Josiah, he died faithful. He died in the battle. And it was a judgment upon the evangelical movement in Britain at that time. And when you look at the horrible decline that there has been throughout the 20th century and into the 21st century, well, we can see where it all came from. Spurgeon was a prophet in his own day and generation. His books are well worth reading, studying, learning, and his preaching is well worth following, because he was a man that knew God. Oh, the curse of apostasy. And when God removes his faithful servants, we've got to pray that God would raise up preachers who would have the voice of the prophet to warn the nation against sin and judgment. And when God removes that voice, when there's a famine for the hearing of the word of the Lord, the land is in a dire place indeed. Finally, let's think about the weeping prophet. Verse 25, and Jeremiah lamented for Josiah. It's dreadful to read the account of a faithful man of God, the violent death, the archers. He's sore wounded. He brought bleeding back to Jerusalem. He dies, and he's buried in the sepulchres of his fathers. But all Judah and Jerusalem mourned. And the singing men and the singing women spake of Josiah in their lamentations, and it would seem, although the words weren't inspired and they weren't preserved, yet there was a book written, The Lamentations for King Josiah. And we call those kinds of ballads laments. His death was lamented. Jeremiah, the prophet, led the laments. Of course, this would change his life too. Because Jeremiah, the prophet, had seen the great days of revival, and now he would have to take a stand in days of sin, and days when judgment was coming. And you read the book of Jeremiah, and it's a story of how Jeremiah preached God's word in a dark, dark day. And no doubt the revival that he saw prepared him for that dark, dark day. Not everyone, you know, will serve God in days of what we call blessing, when thousands of souls are saved. Some are called, like Jeremiah, to serve God in harsh times. If you were to assess Jeremiah's ministry by the popularity that he had amongst the people, you would say he was a failure. But he wasn't a failure. He was one man who stood for God, influenced by King Josiah. But And I think this is where Josiah's legacy really came into its own. As a result of his work of reform, and I mentioned this last week, a remnant was gathered together. That remnant would influence a young Daniel who would go to Babylon. That remnant would influence a young Ezekiel who would go to Babylon. That remnant would influence some who would raise up children in Babylon. And amongst those children would be the likes of Zerubbabel, Ezra, Nehemiah. You see, judgment had come, but the end had not come. God was not finished. And God is not finished with his work today in this age in which we live. And we are never to despair, but take hope. Whatever happens, God is in control. That's the real lesson. And let's get our eyes upon that fact as we come to pray tonight. Thank you for joining us, those on the live stream. And do join with us in prayer in your own homes and in your own families at this time. So let's get before the Lord now for prayer. And let's seek his face.